This is an ABC podcast.
This is The Money. I'm Richard Aidy. Today, we'll look at how a multinational company like Netflix can have lots of subscribers in Australia and yet pay not a lot of tax, absolutely legally, by the way, and how quotas for women in different industries can have an economic payoff. That's later. Let's start with India. It's going through a COVID-19 catastrophe. At the moment, each day brings more than 380,000 new infections. There's been 21 million cases and over 230,000 people have died. It's a human disaster. And as you can imagine, it has a profound economic impact. To get some more insight into that, I spoke to Gabriella D'Souza. She's an Indian-Australian economist working at the Committee for Economic Development of Australia.
So what's going on in India is just devastating for so many reasons. There's a real sense of shared grief and trauma with just the scale of destruction that's happening there. And no doubt a secondary issue to that will be the ability for people to fend for themselves during this crisis financially and, you know, being able to keep a roof over their heads. Like with most places, India has some of the same issues that, you know, we had here in terms of there are some jobs where people are able to transition to working from home quite easily. So, for example, the services sector was able to move to work from home quite substantially during the crisis. And I know from friends who work in, consulting sector back in India, you know, quite a few of them who were living in Bangalore just gave up their leases and they knew that their workplaces weren't going back to work until at least late 2022. So they just, you know, they've just kind of packed up their offices and gone to live with their parents.
It is like here in that way, in that if your job enables you to stay at home, you're probably fine. Although I'm wondering what it would mean for, there's a lot of back office work in India for front offices which are in Europe or the United States or Canada or even here. I wonder if that's been moved to a different location in the same way.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I can't speak to that. But obviously, you know, having said that about the services sector, there's obviously some instances, you know, in the primary sector or in the agricultural sector or in the secondary sector, in the manufacturing sector, which can't move to online as well and can't transition to other forms of work as seamlessly. And we saw that happen after the government's first lockdown. So when the first wave happened around March, the central government mandated a countrywide lockdown. And, you know, we saw some quite brutal economic figures that came out of that. So we saw GDP drop, you know, 25% in that first quarter. So that was quite devastating for the economy. And obviously the central government has decided to stay away from such measures this time around. Obviously that hasn't stopped the states and the local panchayats from implementing their own lockdown measures to try and stop the spread of this virus.
Yeah, it's a point worth making. India is a federal country, like as we are, and different parts of the country have handled this in different ways. But I do remember that first lockdown. There was basically a travel ban, and there were some terrible scenes, and of course, terrible outcomes from that. But obviously, that travel ban just ended up costing the economy too much.
Look, you know, it's a hard calculus, right? You are weighing up the economy against people's lives. We don't know what the counterfactual would have been. We don't know how many lives would have been lost had they not implemented that travel ban. You know, one of the things that I'm really concerned about is that, you know, with the lack of a travel ban, you know, good idea as it might be, there's going to be a lot of people who were working in the urban areas who might not have work anymore, who might go back to their regional towns and back to their home and might bring the virus with them. And those regional centres don't have great healthcare.
Yeah.
So I'm really worried for those sectors.
This is where there's a contrast with a place like Australia where we had JobKeeper, we had JobSeeker. As I understand it, there isn't anything like that in India.
Yeah, and the Indian labour market is pretty informal. The vast majority of people do not have paid leave entitlements, about 80 to 90%, depending on which estimates you take. So the ability to do stuff like JobKeeper in India is pretty limited. I know the central bank has been trying to inject liquidity into the system to make sure that people have access to credit should they need it, and that banks have access to credit because they're really worried about the fallout from that. But, you know, it's tough, and Australia also has very, very low interest rates. The interest rates in India are slightly higher, so the ability for governments to borrow at the rate that we have is also less, and just the ability to get that kind of money into people's pockets is less.
Last month, actually just last week, I think, end of April anyway, India's central bank was noting how resilient the economy was in some sectors. Does that make sense to you?
We'll just have to wait and see, I think. There'll be some sectors that, you know, will probably be okay. So maybe some of the services sectors whose demand is mostly grown from international businesses and advanced Western economies, where obviously they're rebounding quite quickly. So maybe some of the demand for their workforce might still exist. Those sectors might rebound quite quickly.
I want to ask you about confidence. We have seen here, but also in other countries as well, how quickly confidence can be affected. And of course, enormous role confidence plays in the economy. What do you think is going to happen to confidence in India?
So yes, obviously we know that certainty in the economy is a huge, huge aspect of community confidence and consumer confidence and economic confidence more broadly. And when you have the situation that India is going through now, it's hard to feel any kind of certainty. I have family that's in India, and I know they're really scared. They don't know what's going to happen. They're worried about catching the virus. A lot of our friends and family have died from the virus. So it's really heartbreaking. And, you know, I know for my mom, watching a lot of her friends get sick has been really awful for her. So none of this is contributing to confidence in any sense of the word, and especially not economic confidence.
That's it. And of course, when that is your concern, what's happening to people you love and the fear that you might hold for yourself, economic confidence is a kind of second or third order issue, isn't it?
Especially when, you know, we're talking about whether or not states are running out of oxygen supplies. Like, this is pretty basic stuff.
On a bigger scale, even than India, it's an increasingly global power. I think it's something like the fifth largest economy in the world. The effect on India's economy is going to affect all of us in some ways, isn't it?
Yes, that is definitely one aspect of this crisis, is that, you know, we do live in a globalized economy, and what happens in one country has knock-on effects on the other. I mean, I guess one of the crucial ones is that India was the largest producer of the AstraZeneca vaccine and was exporting it to a lot of developing countries. India has been one of the largest producers of pharmaceuticals for a long time. In fact, it's one of the largest producers of other types of vaccines as well. So obviously that's going to have a huge knock-on effect for the rest of the economy. I don't think it's possible to understate just how big this is going to be.
Gabriella, I appreciate that you've got a lot on your mind at the moment. Thank you very much for giving us the time today.
Thank you, Richard.
Gabriella D'Souza is an Indian-Australian economist, I should say. She works at CEDA, the Committee for Economic Development of Australia. This is The Money on RN, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Aidy. One sector that's had quite the pandemic is streaming media. That's not surprising. When you can't go out for entertainment, your screen brings it to you. Big series like The Crown, Tiger King, The Queen's Gambit, Bridgerton, you could well have watched them. You've almost certainly heard of them. They're all on Netflix. So you'd think Netflix has had a good year. Well, yes, and yet no. Rodney Brown is an expert on taxation and financial accounting. He's at the University of New South Wales.
Well, according to the latest audited financial statements that were lodged with ASIC last week, Netflix's Australian subsidiary paid $581,000 in cash taxes in 2020, which is an increase of around $36,000 from 2019. That $581,000 in taxes is based on revenue of around $20 million and profits of around $1.5 million, both of which have increased since 2019. Interestingly, I'd say that the level of tax paid gives an effective tax rate of around 40%, which is much higher than the corporate tax rate in Australia of 30%. But I think the issue that some people have expressed concern about is not so much the effective tax rate, which on the face of it looks pretty good. Mm. It's the amount of revenues and profits that Netflix is recognising in Australia, which does seem low when we're looking at subscriber numbers. And of course, the amount of revenue and profit that they recognise here in Australia drives the ultimate amount of taxes that they pay here.
Yeah, because and if we think about last year, obviously there's a pandemic-induced lockdown, people not going to the movies, people not really going much of anywhere, and I know certainly at my place we watched a lot of Netflix.
Sure. Yeah, that's correct. Look, I had a look at the Netflix Inc., which is the parent company of Netflix Australia. I had a look at their accounts and they had some benefit from lockdowns. Their subscriber numbers around the world increased about 22% from 167 million people in 2019 to 204 million in 2020. Now, Netflix Australia doesn't disclose its local subscriber numbers, but there has been some estimates from a few market research companies in the media and technology space here. And they estimate that Netflix has around 5.5 million to 6 million subscribers in Australia. So effectively, the Australian subscriber base accounts for roughly 3% of their global subscriber base. But I think the issue that has been raised is, despite Australia accounting for 3% of their global subscriber numbers, the revenues and profits booked in Australia are less than 1%, more like less than half of 1%. And so that seems to be the issue, that the revenues and profits booked here in Australia are rather low compared to the subscriber numbers that Australia accounts for.
We should say at this point that everything is completely legal. Netflix have made a point of saying, we comply with Australian taxes and indeed international taxes. And indeed, that's a bit of a litany for companies that are multinational like Netflix. They say that all the time. But is this going to be something that you would think that the ATO would think, well, hang on, those numbers seem suspiciously low?
Absolutely, you're right. It is all completely legal. And that's a really important point for people to understand, that and many of the multinationals that are accused of tax avoidance refute such allegations on the basis they're in full compliance with Australian tax laws and international tax laws. And to be frank, I believe that the vast majority are doing just that. And of course, we want multinational companies and all companies, all businesses to follow the law, whether it be occupational health and safety law, consumer protection law, or tax law. But the issue here is, if we want to change the outcome, and that outcome being these big multinationals paying more taxes, then we need to change the underlying tax law. So, look, the ATO would probably have a look at this, but they have access to much more detailed information than what's presented in the public accounts that are lodged with ASIC. So it is an area that ATO looks at for all multinationals, but I would estimate Netflix are in full compliance with the laws as they currently stand.
For people who are not familiar with this, when you pay Netflix, I think most of us would guess that's going to Netflix's office somewhere in Sydney or Melbourne, but it's not, is it? It's actually going across to the other side of the world.
That's true. So the corporate structure they use gives them some flexibility as to which countries they recognise revenues and profits, regardless of their physical presence in those countries. So this is very common with large multinational technology companies, and it's been the cause of concern for governments and the OECD and the G20 for some years now. So when it comes to Netflix, yes, even though they have a subsidiary in Australia, most of the transactions are recognised outside of Australia. So the principal activity of Netflix's Australian operations is to provide services to Netflix International BV and Netflix Inc. Now, Netflix International BV is a Dutch company, so located in the Netherlands, and it's the ultimate parent company of Netflix Australia. So this may come as a surprise to some of the listeners, but it's not Netflix Australia who bills Australian subscribers. Yeah. Rather, it's the Netherlands-based company that does this, and it's the Netherlands-based company that books the profits or books the revenue from the Australian subscribers in its accounts. So Netflix Australia merely collects the subscriber fees on behalf of the Dutch company and charges a fee for that service.
Right.
So the majority of the revenues is recognised in the Netherlands.
So when you think you're paying Netflix Australia, you probably don't think it through, but you would assume you're paying Netflix Australia, but in fact, you're paying the money which will go to the Netherlands, and Netflix Australia charges the fee for collecting it, more or less.
Correct.
So a few years ago now, we've already touched on the ATO, but the ATO made noises about capturing more tax revenue from multinationals, technology firms in particular, but not just them. I mean, we see it with any very large international concerns. You've got energy companies and mining companies, which are also able to take advantage of having different subsidiaries in different parts of the world. How successful has that push from the ATO been?
Yeah, look, I think in a nutshell, I think it's been quite successful. Basically, several important initiatives came out of the Senate inquiry into corporate tax avoidance, which started in 2014 and ran through to 2018. And I think the most important initiative that came out of that was additional funding that the ATO was given to establish the Tax Avoidance Task Force, which was established in 2016. And that was a aimed squarely at detecting tax avoidance and protecting government revenue and maintaining the integrity of the tax system. And out of that came the multinational anti-avoidance law and the diverted profits tax, or the DPT, that came in 2016 and 2017 respectively. Now, as at June last year, the ATO has stated that it's raised, or that task force has raised, around $18.4 billion in additional tax liabilities. So, I don't think it's perfect. There's always room for improvement, but I think it's generally recognised that the ATO has done a really good job on this front. Mm.
But there are, in fact, Rodney, I understand, wheels in motion at an international level that will try and do a better job.
Yes, there are. And most importantly, they are focused on changing the way multinationals are taxed. So they're basically tearing up the old international tax rules and principles that have been in place since the early 1900s, but no longer suit the digital economy of today. So the OECD and the G20 have been developing a plan over several years to change the tax laws to counteract multinationals shifting profits to low tax countries or tax havens. Those proposals have been in deadlock for a while, but in recent weeks, the US have come on board, which is fantastic, and Joe Biden has received lots of praise for that. So the OECD blueprint is really based on two pillars, and that's the first, which is around changing the allocation of taxing rights. So that's based on where companies earn their profits, so where the customers reside, irrespective of where the company's physical presence is or the extent of their physical presence in a country. And the second pillar, which has received a lot of press in recent weeks, is around a minimum global tax rate. And the US has proposed a minimum global tax rate of 21%.
Mm. So how will these help? I guess, say, in the example we were talking about earlier, for example, Netflix, and of course we're at pains to say they've not done anything illegal at all. If this could all come in, it won't be that the money goes to the Netherlands from Australia. Netflix effectively will be assessed on how much money it's making in Australia, no matter where it ends up.
Yeah, exactly. So the rules under the first pillar, pillar one, means that large tech companies would be forced to pay taxes to national governments based on the sales they make in each country, irrespective of where they're based. So the rules under this pillar would likely affect Netflix. Mm-hmm. And under the second pillar, national governments can still set the corporate tax rates at the country level. But if companies pay a lower tax rate in a particular country, say Ireland, which is at 12.5%, then the home government of that company can claim a top-up tax, if you will, to the agreed minimum rate. So this effectively eliminates the advantages of companies shifting their profits to low tax countries or tax havens. So overall, the combination of these rules would result in a better alignment between a multinational's economic presence in a country, so that's primarily where their customers are, mm-hmm. and the revenues and the profits they recognise in that particular country, which obviously drives the ultimate amount of taxes they pay in that country.
Will it affect the countries that have sold themselves as low or no tax, so places like Bermuda or even, as you mentioned, Ireland or the Netherlands, which we were talking about earlier? Won't they kick up against this or try to negate it in some way?
Well, interestingly, in the past couple of weeks, several of those low-tax nations have publicly responded in a positive way to the reform plans, even though they will likely lose out. For example, Ireland have said that they're in favour of the agreement because it will bring stability to the international tax framework. And I think the Netherlands have stated that it's a huge step towards finding global solutions and developing effective tax rules. And Luxembourg have made similar claims. So that's positive, but you know, it remains to be seen whether these countries will try to have some elements of the proposals watered down during the political process that still needs to take place. It's certainly in their interest to do so because you know, these are small countries that use tax policy as a lever to compensate for their the small size and the small number of natural resources, for instance, that they have.
Yeah. So what's the time frame on this, Rodney?
Well, under negotiations at the moment, but the G20 finance ministers are scheduled to meet again in early July. And so there appears to be genuine momentum to reach a consensus by then. Now that the US is on board, Joe Biden, I think, wants to push this through pretty quickly to help raise more taxes to fund his big spending program. And also part of the deal is that it would force countries like Australia to rewind the initiatives that they've put in at the country levels. But there's also elections in France and Germany coming up later this year. So the OECD will really want to push this forward and reach agreement by mid this year so the plans don't get put on hold like they did last year in the US in the lead up to the US federal election.
If it happens, what kind of level of tax would Netflix, the example we started talking about, what would they end up paying? Any idea?
I've done some rough calculations and I think that if Netflix were to allocate revenues and profits based on subscriber numbers, so effectively where their customers reside, they would recognise around $1 billion in revenue in Australia. And I'm kind of talking in the ballpark of around $70 million in profit and around $25 million in taxes. So, a huge increase compared to what's currently being paid here.
Rodney Brown, thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Rodney Brown's at the School of Accounting, Auditing and Taxation at the University of New South Wales. This is The Money. I'm Richard Adey. The Morrison government is letting it be known that this budget will contain plenty for women. But what we won't see in the budget are quotas. Quotas requiring businesses and organisations to employ a specific percentage of women. Quotas are a tool for tackling inequality. But Alison Pullen from Macquarie University Business School says they could also have an economic benefit.
In relation to the economy, post-COVID, if we can call our times post-COVID in Australia, we need to be looking at women's participation in the economy. If we don't address women's participation in the economy in Australia now, because it is an urgent matter, then we won't achieve economic recovery because women are key to economic recovery because of skill shortages in sectors that have been previously filled by casual and immigrant workers. So the idea of quotas being used is not just to use quotas in political and big business, but also to think about can all businesses, all parts of the economy reflect the population.
One of the things you touched on there was our skill shortages, which, as you say, we normally fill with immigration, which of course has stopped. Are you saying that we can address some of these skill shortages by using quotas?
Yeah, I think we need to ask Australian businesses to think about the ways in which their workforce are representing Australian society. Women were largely affected with job losses during COVID. And we also know that some businesses are not very good at hiring women and other minority groups. So, yeah, I think given that we see some sectors, the hospitality sector, the care work sector, now have skill shortages, we could use quotas to ensure that our services employ women and other groups.
All right. Well, how could it work? What quotas should they be? How long would organisations have to comply? Those sorts of things.
Well, when quotas were first introduced in France, the aim was to achieve 50-50 in political representation. Over time, there has been increases in women into political parties because it was legislated. In Belgium, they also legislated quotas in parliamentary parties and in business. And in the early 90s, it went from 19% women's representation to then 25% in the late 90s, and then to 36% a bit later on. This is slow progress, but it is some progress. So I think unless government legislate, change won't happen.
So the reason to bring the quotas in is for equity, for equality. But you're also saying that if we did it, we would get an economic bump out of that. It would help our economy.
Yes, absolutely. Having quotas and ensuring that women are represented for equality and for fairness of decision making will actually boost the economy by ensuring that investment is made in areas that not only protect the most vulnerable members of society, but also boost big business as well.
As you say, as you talk about this, I'm thinking, you know, we have in a way done this before, not with quotas, but because we absolutely had to. So in the war, in World War II, because men were often called up to fight or went off to fight, women had to do the jobs that men had done. And they did. I suppose what I'm saying is we know we can do this. It's just having the political will.
Yeah, I agree. And, I think the fact that we are in 2021 and having this conversation regarding women's capabilities and desire to be in the labour market is a sign of the cultural problem that Australia has about valuing who can participate fully in the economy and who can't. For some time, many women commentators have been saying that there's a problem with existing government in addressing women's safety and economic participation. Women have made enormous progress in politics and in entering decision-making spaces. But we need more women, and we need women to be acting on behalf of other women, making it easier for women who are excluded from the labour market to enter it, whether that's in relation to creating flexible workspaces, whether it's in terms of free childcare, whether it's addressing that there are significant barriers in some workforces that mean that women don't want to enter them and take roles in those organizations and industries, and whether women actually leave these organizations because it's too difficult to work there.
Alison, that is where we're going to have to leave it. But thank you very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Alison Bullen is Professor of Gender, Work and Organisation at Macquarie University Business School. And that's it for now. Next week, we'll dive into the budget. The money's produced by Belinda Summer. Our sound engineer is Simon Braithwaite. I'm Richard Addy.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.